Welcome to the Dinner Party Download. This is your icebreaker.
So here's a joke that makes me feel great. Why did the yogurt go to the art exhibit? To get more cultured.
I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan, and from APM, American Public Media, this is the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that helps you win your week's dinner parties.
You just got a refined, artistic joke from web star and author Issa Rae. That'll help break the ice. She's got a new book, and we'll hear her read from it later. Plus, we speak with actor Eddie Redmayne. He is up for an Oscar for his portrayal of physicist Stephen Hawking in the movie The Theory of Everything.
Also coming up, documentarian Andrew Jarecki talks about his new HBO series and why he's attracted to monsters.
Ooh.
Singer Sana Bosi DJs your winter dance party, and we get tips on not tipping.
But first, as at any party, we start with small talk. All week long, you've been hearing these headlines.
Winners of Super Bowl 49, the Patriots, congratulations.
$3.99 trillion. That's the budget the president is sending to Congress.
Harper Lee is publishing a second novel 55 years after the release of the classic To Kill a Mockingbird.
Now for a story you might not have heard. We are speaking with Erin McCann. She is news editor at The Guardian newspaper. Erin, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I am here to talk about something called Pleripennetta americana, which you may know as the American cockroach.
Oh, do we have to?
We do.
Hate cockroaches.
You're about to hate them more, as if that were possible.
What's happening?
A scientific study has revealed that even cockroaches have different personalities.
Oh.
Different persons? So some of them are nice and some of them are mean?
No, it classifies them as basically shy and cautious or bold or explorers.
But are the shy ones just theoretical because we don't see them? Maybe they're just bold ones who are lazy.
They were tracked by radio tags, which means somebody had to capture like hundreds upon hundreds of tiny little cockroaches, put a radio tag on them, and then track them to
see what
happens.
If that's your job, you probably will be like, hey, these little guys do have personality, because otherwise...
Yeah, otherwise, that's a lonely gig.
Imagine a first date with the person whose job that is. So, how was your day? I caught 1,200 cockroaches today.
And put tiny, tiny transmitters upon them.
The story is actually amusing. It says, the discovery is unlikely to change perceptions of cockroaches from skittering vermin to desirable beasts. But it could
Correct.
Go some... it could go some way to explaining their evolutionary success.
But why would the two personalities help them survive? It would seem like the bold ones will crawl out and get killed. That's a terrible idea.
It seems the shy ones, they keep hidden as much as possible, while the more adventurous ones are keen to explore their surroundings. So I think you probably need both in a species.
Yeah. All right. So what I take from this is that we destroy the bold ones and then the rest of the species goes away.
Yes.
Great.
Let's work on that.
Thank you for the small talk and a battle plan, Erin McCann.
Thank you.
And now, time for cocktails.
Nice. Once again, we tell you something that happened in history, then ask a bartender to capture its essence in cocktail form.
It's like attending history class at a pub.
For free. Hmm. First, the history part. Around this time back in 1957, Wham-O Toy Company started selling one of its most popular items.
Michelle Philippi tells the tale.
Fred Morrison launched a career with the flick of his wrist. It was 1937, and the teenage Morrison was at a backyard party with his girlfriend Lucille. At some point, he grabbed the top off a popcorn tin and tossed it to her. To their delight, it sailed smoothly through the air. After some experimenting, they learned cake pans were more aerodynamic. And they were tossing one of those around at the beach one day when some dude wandered up and offered to buy it for a quarter. The pan had cost Fred 5 cents. Eureka! A business was born. Fred and Lucille started selling modified cake pans to Santa Monica beachgoers, and later, Fred teamed up with a business partner to make better flying discs, made of plastic. With UFO sightings suddenly all the rage, Fred named his product the Flying Saucer. In 1957, though, Wham-O Toy Company bought the rights to Fred's invention and changed its name after they heard about college kids in Bridgeport, Connecticut, who'd nicknamed the pie-shaped saucer after a local pie company, Frisbee.
If you want fun, get Frisbee today. And remember, if it doesn't say whammo, it isn't a Frisbee. $1 wherever toys are sold.
Fred later said he found the saucer's new name, quote, a horror. But the millions of dollars in royalties he earned probably helped ease the pain. Meanwhile, Wham-O executive Ed Hedrick modified the Frisbee and invented a sport to play with it, disc golf. After he died, his ashes were molded into Frisbees.
So that was the history lesson. Now for the drink to go along with it, I'm on the line with Alan Heedy. He's a bartender at Taltog Tavern in Bridgeport, Connecticut, formerly home to the Frisbee Pie Company, where the Frisbee got its name. Alan, what drink did this story inspire you to make?
It inspired me to make a cherry pie martini that we are calling the Kossuth Flyer, named after the street that the pie company was on, was Kossuth Street.
Is that near you?
It's on the east side of Bridgeport.
Okay.
And we figured we'd throw in the word flyer just because of the Frisbee.
Very cool. Well, it's doubly suitable then. So tell me what's in your drink.
Well, you take a martini glass, and what you want to do is rim it with a pre-made mix of crumbled up pie crust, brown sugar, and a little bit of salt.
Okay.
And then you take cherry vodka and vanilla vodka, put it in a mixer, and stir it for Frisbee sakes. And then you strain it into the martini glass, float a little bit of cherry juice or grenadine on the bottom, and then garnish it with two cherries on a skewer.
Gotcha. And so this is going to look red?
The bottom tip is going to be red, and the rest will be clear if you float the vodka and the cherry juice correctly.
And then when you're done, you just throw the martini glass across the room as if it were a Frisbee.
Of course. That's how you ask for another, actually.
Had you ever heard of, did you know about this origin story of the Frisbee?
I actually did. Ever since I've lived in Connecticut, history has just been my big interest.
Uh-huh.
And so anything that Connecticut has come up with or made, or I've just done research upon research when I was a history major, including the wiffle ball bat, Colt, GE.
Wait, the wiffle ball bat's also from Connecticut?
Yep.
Wow. Between naming the Frisbee, inventing the wiffle ball bat, and like Mystic Pizza, Connecticut has leisure time on lockdown.
Pretty much.
And Rico, the people at Wham-O went on to create the hula hoop, the super ball, the slip and slide, the hacky sack, and silly string.
Wow.
Total party over there, Wham-O.
Here's my question. What do you do for fun when making that stuff is your job?
Exactly.
You know?
Clean gutters for kicks.
You sit in a cubicle and move papers around.
Hey, can I help you move your apartment?
That's a blast. Or everybody, you could make cocktails like the one you just heard about. The recipes are at dinnerpartydownload.org.
All right, we've made small talk, thrown around some cocktails. All we need to get this party moving is some music to play.
And here to help with that is Swedish soul singer Sanna Bosse. The 24-year-old has already sung at the Nobel Peace Prize concert, and she graced a Swedish postage stamp. She recently put out her first EP called For Madeline. Here she is with a party playlist that indicates she's a little tired of the Swedish winter.
Hello, my name is Sanna Bosse, and this is my dinner party soundtrack. We start the night off with listening to some dancehall because I love dancehall music. Maybe we should start soft, but that wouldn't be realistic really in my life. So I'd listen to a song called Like a Man by a dancehall artist named Spice.
Now, Spice, we all know that this is a male-dominated business.
The song is really funny because it's all about, like, she's like, okay, so men make more money. Let me sound like a man.
You think they would hurry it no more?
And then she just goes really low, and everyone's face goes, what? When they hear that the first time.
All right, then, make me DJ like, come on. Girl, wine pon the beat, or this a fi boom pon. Every girl a wine and a go down. Girl, wine like a cartel, I sing this a song.
My ideal party would actually be just inviting my friends into my little studio apartment in Stockholm, and I'd probably cook some food from Gambia, which is where my dad is from, and I grew up there a little bit as well. Pretty spicy food, so the apartment tends to get really like hot and everyone gets flustered from the pepper, and then you can kind of transport yourself to Africa or wherever you actually want to be when it's snowing outside and pretty cold all the time.
The more.
Song number two would be this new Rihanna single called 4 or 5 Seconds.
I think I've had enough. I might get a little drunk.
She just sings really, really amazing. Her vocals are wicked in this song. I actually believe her whole rebellious spirit that she has. And I've heard things about her that I really like. For example, that she always cranks up the temperature in the room wherever she is. And I can so relate to that, like never wanting to freeze.
Now I'm 4 or 5 seconds from wildin'. And we got 3 more days till Friday.
It actually features Paul McCartney and Kanye West. Paul McCartney is like playing this really weird guitar and Kanye is just singing absolutely terribly in this song. But he has feeling, he has a vibe.
Woke up an optimist. Sun was shining, I'm positive.
We can run.
Then I heard you was talking trash.
How about a mystery?
Hold me back, I'm about to spaz.
Yeah, I'm about 4 or 5 seconds from wild.
If I was in a room with those three, I'd just sit in the corner and stare. Probably just stare and listen.
I'm trying to make it back home by Monday morning. I swear I somebody with them, that's all I want.
Then the third song would be Miss Fat Booty with Mos Def, just because I really, really love him and I'm kind of married to him in my brain. And he's sampling Aretha Franklin from her song One Step Ahead, so that's a good thing. Love her. It's just really soulful and vibey and amazing storytelling.
Yo, in she came with the same type game, the type of girl giving out the fake cell phone, the name. Big thing, big, she like catching big things. Jewel ship, money clip, phone flip, the 6 range.
And it has this really nice hip hop vibe, and I know all the lyrics, and all of my friends know the lyrics. Just rap along, which is the best thing to do at a party, really, when everyone knows the song.
Damn, what's your name, love? Where you came from? Neck and wrist laced up, very little makeup. The swims at the Reebok.
See, if I had a dinner party, my sister would probably be the DJ, and she would probably play one of my songs. I'd be too self-conscious to do that, but she'd play Younger.
There's a conclusion to my illusion, I assure you this. There's no end to this confusion if you let it wish you well. Soul to sell, highest bidders, can't you tell what you're getting?
I wrote it about not really knowing what to do with my musical career because I was really procrastinating. So I wrote a song about kind of seizing the day. Or the night, if you're going out.
Well, get it while you can, babe, cause you know you ain't getting any
younger, younger, younger.
Are you?
Younger, younger, younger.
Are you?
A dinner party soundtrack from Swedish soul singer Sanna Bosse. Her debut EP For Madeline is out now.
All right, everybody, we're going to take a break, but coming up, actor Eddie Redmayne tells us his secret.
I'm winging it, mate. I have no idea what I'm doing.
Gives me hope.
Me too.
When the dinner party download continues. Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, culture, food, and humor to fuel your party conversations. I'm Brendan Francis Newnham.
I'm Rico Galliano. Coming up, author Issa Rae explains how she keeps people's hands off her hair. But first, let's meet our guest of honor.
And this week, it's actor Eddie Redmayne. He was best known for his role in the film Les Miserables, but his turn as physicist Stephen Hawking in the movie The Theory of Everything has changed all that.
Yep.
He's already won a Golden Globe for the performance, and he's up for an Oscar. Here's a clip in which a young Hawking, already affected by the motor neuron disease that would soon paralyze him, receives his PhD.
An extraordinary theory.
Thank you.
So what next?
Prove it. Prove with a single equation that time had a beginning. Wouldn't that be nice, Professor? The one simple, elegant equation to explain everything.
When I spoke with Eddie, I asked him to quickly explain Hawking's theory.
Please don't make me do that.
Come on.
Literally makes me start sweating. It was my biggest fear making this film, was having to promote the film and people asking me questions about the intricacies of his theories. I'm not going to embarrass myself.
Okay, no. I'm teasing. From reading other interviews you've done about this movie, you went to great lengths to kind of accurately portray Hawking and his deteriorating physical condition due to ALS. And you do a tremendous job projecting his mind and heart out of his kind of eroded body.
Oh, thank you.
And a lot of the performance comes down to your eyes. Just a mechanical, how does that work? How does an actor train or use their eyes to get across so much?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is when I met Stephen, even though he can use very few muscles, he has one of the most expressive and charismatic faces I've ever seen. Hmm. And the way I describe it, it's as if all of those facilities that one has as an able-bodied person, whether it's gesture or even tone of voice, all of those, it's as if all of those energies are channeled into those few muscles that he can use. And it's minutiae of expression. It's really, it's formidable to sort of watch. So in the end, I wish I could say there was a better way than, but I just had an iPad with all of the footage that I could find of Stephen, and I would wait for my wife to go to work, and I would sit in front of the mirror, and I would try and learn to sort of, to use, isolate those muscles that he uses. But when he smiles, like the world is a greater place. So I worked on my smile.
And he does, you imbue him with a kind of a sly sense of humor and a certain mirth that I think comes as a surprise to people who haven't seen documentaries of him.
Mm.
You know, there's so much physical work that you had to do, as well as the kind of mental work of, you know, this wasn't shot chronologically. You're doing different Hawkings at different times. Was there a trick that you did? I mean,
No, there wasn't really. I worked with a dancer, actually. I had about 4 months between when I was cast and when I started filming. And I thought I would try and learn the different stages of physicality because, as you said, we weren't shooting chronologically. So you'd have to jump into different periods of his life within the same day. I tried to learn the different stages of physicality like a dance so that you would know the confines, as it were, the sort of steps within which you were able to move. But within that, you could then find a freedom of expression. So I don't know if there was a trick. I could have done with a trick, actually.
Well, next time.
Thank you. Next time I'll go in search.
This movie is about love. How did you view, and I know you've met Stephen and Jane a couple times, but how did you view their relationship after reading the script, and did your view of it change as you made your way through the film and even after the film?
I thought the relationship was pretty real. I mean, what as you say, it's a love story, but what I thought was intriguing about it was like a scrutiny of love. It was a, in some ways, a celebration and dissection of love in all its guises. So you have young, passionate love when they first meet. You then have you have the love of subject matter for Jane and for Stephen. You then have family love, but also the boundaries, the limitations of love, and so through really it was all there on the page in Anthony McCartan's script, and the more investigation I did and the more time I spent with Jane and Stephen, who are good friends now despite everything that they, you know, or in spite of everything they've been through, it's a different type of love now, I suppose.
So you were also in the movie My Week with Marilyn, a movie that examines the life of another world-renowned figure, Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
And in this, you play a world-renowned figure. Now, I'm not saying you're a world-renowned figure, but it's undeniable that your profile has been raised quite a bit recently. Is there anything you learned from examining those two characters that maybe are some principles you've brought into your own life about how to process fame?
God, what a good question. No, there were weird connections that connected these two films, but principally that Stephen loves Marilyn Monroe. And,
oh, really?
And he always said if he could time travel, he would go back and meet her. He has a photo in his office of a Marilyn Monroe lookalike and him in the foreground. She's standing next to this car, and it was actually something we recreated in our film. It was my own, like, sort of slightly ridiculous in-joke to myself.
Yeah.
I think
you're just winging it on your own.
I'm winging it, mate. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm just trying to put one foot in front of the other.
Certainly.
Frankly.
We have some recurring questions we ask some of our guests.
Cool.
And one of them is,
tell us something we don't know. And this can be a personal fact you haven't shared in interviews, or it can be kind of an interesting piece of trivia about the world.
Personal fact about me. Crikey. scraping at the barrel here.
How about, I know you did a lot of research for this film. Is there an interesting fact about Steven and his life that maybe didn't make it on the screen?
One of my favorite stories of his was about, there was this wonderful nurse who works as part of his team, and she had a job interview with him, and she'd literally just graduated from nursing school, and she was terrified. She was meeting Stephen Hawking. It was her first job interview. And she arrived there that morning and really bricking it, kind of scared. And he asked her one question, which was, can you make poached eggs? to which she responded yes, and she got the job. And somehow in that one like conversation summed up just so much of his brilliance.
It captures his sense of humor. Was there another edge to that? Whereas if she had a certain confidence to field that question, that's the sort of person he wanted near
maybe
him?
I don't know, but I feel like it was just a sort of, it just showed his sort of confidence in himself in some ways as well.
Well, I will turn the question back to you. Do you know how to make poached eggs?
No, I hate eggs.
Oh, really?
I literally can't be dealing. The most eggy I can get is an omelette. Like, I'm having to sort of educate myself to like, but anything more eggy than that is my worst nightmare.
Actor, egg hater, Eddie Redmayne. And Rico, as you know, Hawking lost his voice and uses a speech generation device.
Of course.
Well, he let Redmayne use that exact device in the movie. So the voice you hear in the film literally is Hawking's voice.
Wow.
It's kind of cool.
So while Hawking was off doing equations somewhere, his voice was on the set?
That's right.
That's, I think, amazing.
It's like a space-time continuum thing.
Time to eavesdrop.
Issa Rae created and stars in a web series that's earned tens of millions of views on YouTube and is about to become a pilot for HBO. Issa's debut book comes out this week. Today we overhear an excerpt.
Hey, my name is Issa Rae, most known for my web series, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. And I have a new book called The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. Surprise, surprise. The book is part memoir and part guides for the awkward. And I'd love to read you an excerpt. It's called ABG Guide, The Hair Advantage. For the masses, the hair of the awkward black girl, and even boy, is an enigma. Though not generally known, NASA is examining our strands of hair for space research, as its gravity-defying properties are key to missing answers in the field of aeronautics. Its buoyancy and ability to shrink when exposed to water is also rumored to be studied by scientists interested in underwater living. For the awkward black girl, it is important to view hair as the ultimate form of expression. But there remains a sensitivity with our hair when others express unwarranted opinions and questions. Even within the black community, hair adjectives like laid, fried, nappy, whipped, dry, and snatched are all used to convey approval or disapproval, as if they assess not just hair, but also character, quality of life, and decision-making skills. When dealing with people who pose so-called questions, even as they judge you, here are some foolproof responses. Question: is it real? Thanks to the widespread popularity of hair extensions, this question is no longer asked solely within the black community. Some people are even desensitized to the question. For those who aren't, the proper response is usually, is yours? With a smile. Passive aggression is absolutely appropriate in this instance. Question: can I touch it? The dreaded question that many with ethnically expansive hair have heard countless times. A simple, are your hands clean? Not only infantilizes the request, but it also sends a message that your hair isn't the sheep exhibit at the petting zoo. Should you decide to decline the request, a polite, I'd rather you not, should do the trick. If you see that the asker's spirit is crushed and you're inclined to care, simply qualify your denial with, I'm very tender-headed. Question: how did you get your hair like that? If the question's context refers to a complicated hairstyle, i.e. gravity-defying twists or an insanely thick side bun, this question is acceptable. If this question refers to one's hair texture, i.e., can I make my hair nappy like yours? Then we have a problem. So as not to exhaust oneself by explaining genetics, an appropriate response would be, I woke up like this. Opinion. I wish my hair did that. Ah, hair envy. There is no proper response to appease those who can't achieve the natural roots. But this admission, especially given the self-esteem-threatening history of nappy rejection, is always appreciated. An appropriate response is, thanks. By the year 2100, when the world is even more globally connected, with intergalactic travel common and interracial mixing the default, we can expect less of a fascination with the mystery of black hair. Until then, during your lifelong hair journey, understand that many will want to touch your hair, and some will. A number will speculate on its authenticity, proudly exclaim, I can wear my hair however I want, whenever I want, anywhere I want. The advantages of black hair are infinite.
Issa Rae with an excerpt from her new book, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. It's based on her web series, and you're listening to The Dinner Party Download from APM, Aquarticon Public Media.
And now, the main course, the part of the show where we talk about food.
And Brendan, you probably know there's been a lot of debate in the restaurant world about the problems surrounding tipping.
Yes, it causes arguments when you're splitting a check, for one thing.
For one thing. Also, employees who work for tips have unstable, often very low incomes.
Yeah.
That's also one reason it's hard for restaurants to retain workers. Mm. So more and more restaurants are trying alternatives to tips. One that was ahead of the curve is a place called Brand 158 in L.A. There, instead of a tip, you pay a flat 15% service charge, which helps pay the whole staff higher hourly wages. They've been doing this for over a year. So this week I met with Gabriel Frem, who owns the place, and I started by asking how diners have liked the policy.
Overall, and there is always exceptions, but overall it seems that people are appreciating it because it's only 15%. Most people are tipping today 15, 18, or 20% or more, and those who are tipping less than that, then, you know, that's a different issue altogether. That, you know,
we don't care about them.
Yeah, we're not trying to address those right now. But people also, there's a few elements that are associated with the tip that are eliminated when you take the tip out and you put the service charge. One, you're not having to judge another human being with a number. You may or may not have money to show someone your appreciation, and you may not feel that 15% is enough. So now you feel like you have to put 20, 25, or 30. You feel this obligation. Two, you have to do mental math. Most people don't like math.
So that's what cell phones are for now.
Yeah, yeah. So here, you're doing math, you're judging another person. We eliminated that. Three, when you don't have tip in a restaurant, you don't feel as you're sitting and relaxing that you're taking away from the livelihood of that person serving you.
Oh, right, because normally waiters need people to be constantly ordering food so they can constantly be earning tips.
Yeah. When you take the tip out, they're not making money based on how much they're selling you. And I always tell people, imagine paying your babysitter on how many bananas she feeds your child during your absence. I mean, we want a relaxed environment where people can sit back and leave whenever they want to leave and not feel that they are in direct conflict with the compensation model that you put for the person serving them.
But I do have to ask, though, for you as a businessman, that means potentially that you're not getting as much turnover, you're not getting as many people in buying your food. Don't you want to have more turnover?
Well, I can tell you, we're more interested in returning guests than in turning tables. If people develop an emotional relationship with the place, they will come back more often. And, you know, you design the restaurant and your pricing to where if people sat longer and enjoyed themselves, you can make a profit.
Still, it's kind of a hassle to do that. It's not the industry norm. What made this issue kind of important to you? Why did you decide to do this?
One of the reasons is to create stability for our employees so that they can focus on the guest. We feel that if their lives are unstable, if they came to work and didn't know what they're going to make for the week, they would not be focused on the people that they're taking care of. Also, we hire and train our employees, and we don't feel a random guest should be making a payment to them based on calculations that may or may not be reasonable. And we're not comfortable with that. And we feel that we can sustain our employees so that they can stay with us and we don't have the issues that come from a nomadic workforce that's constantly moving around.
Oh, interesting. Have you found over the last year that you've retained more staff than is typical for a restaurant?
Absolutely. Now, I'm not a restaurateur by background in terms of saying, okay, over the last 10 years, I've had this experience, but I've dined. I know a lot of people who own restaurants. The big problem, everybody says, the staff is a problem, retention. Well, if you go to our restaurant, 90%+ of the people who are there were there on opening day. We feel that we end up saving tremendously by having the same staff and having less people on the floor because everybody knows what they're doing. If you had to change...
You actually have fewer waiters on the floor?
I think relative to the typical restaurant, we can operate at every level with less people because they are veterans. They know what they're doing. I mean, people get better with time when they're doing something. They work together better. You can't just create a unified culture if your people are being changed every 3 to 4 weeks. I was talking to someone who said to me, my aunt has a restaurant. She has 16 employees. Last year, she sent 124 W-2s. That many people she changed in 1 year because every 3 to 4 weeks, someone, they got to move on. And you have that type of vicious cycle going on. But people think they're saving money. I don't think they're saving money this way.
So far, you and a few others that are starting to pop up are the exceptions to the rule. Is this a trend you're feeling?
You know what? I hope that the industry wakes up. It is a business interest. It's not a charity thing. I think everybody's trying to run a restaurant basically without paying anyone anything. And it's food. It's a sensitive thing. So you can imagine in the back of the house where people are touching meat and making all of that sensitive stuff for you, if you change them every 3 to 4 weeks, you can only imagine what's happening in these kitchens.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. There are stories. There are shows on TV where the hero chefs walk in and try to look at how many things are wrong and how many roaches are there. Why do you think these things happen a lot? Because you have a labor force that is not committed, that's being changed all the time. And in an era where there is this movement where chefs care that the animals are treated humanely, how about starting to employ people in a humane way?
Gabriel Frem, he owns the LA restaurant Brand 158. By the way, this week in New York, the beloved restaurant Dirt Candy reopened. They've replaced tips with a flat fee.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Coming up, filmmaker Andrew Jarecki sees the good and evil in everyone, including suspected criminals, when the Dinner Party Download continues.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations. I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. In a few minutes, we'll hear a new tune from Unknown Mortal Orchestra, and later filmmaker Andrew Jarecki talks about his new HBO true crime series, The Jinx.
And Brendan, you know it's a true crime.
What's that?
Rudeness. But we do our part to fight it, everybody, with our weekly etiquette segment.
That is correct. Each week, you send in your questions about how to behave. We often tap a random celebrity to answer them, but this week, we have our resident etiquette celebrities, Lizzie Post and Daniel Post Senning. They're the great-great-grandkids of Manners maven Emily Post, co-authors of Emily Post Etiquette, the 18th edition, and they co-host the podcast Awesome Etiquette.
It's awesome.
Lizzie, Dan, welcome back.
Thank you
Gentlemen.
So much.
Are you ready to get people to behave?
Yes, we are.
Wow.
So next week is Valentine's Day. Everyone.
Yay.
And surely, we were talking about this earlier, you must receive a slew of mail with questions about how to behave on this holiday or non-holiday, depending on how you think of it. What's on people's minds? What are common questions you get this time of year?
Biggest thing is when you're just starting out, is it okay to ask someone on a date for Valentine's Day, or does that feel like too much pressure? And then follow up is, we've only been dating a month or two. What kind of gift is appropriate on something like a Valentine's Day? And truthfully, the best thing to do is talk with the person that you're romantically involved with and say, is this something you like to celebrate? Like, what are your feelings about the holiday?
One other just word to the wise, survey results show Valentine's Day matters to long-established couples. So folks out there that are in long-term relationships, married.
Right, who are maybe not going out on dates and have let things get stale.
Yeah. Exactly. Take heed and make an effort. People appreciate it.
I love that they're not the people who are sending you questions.
Yeah.
Both those questions are about new love. Old and established, like, here's your box of chocolates.
Get out of my face. All right. And here's a bunch of other questions that were sent in. Surprisingly, no Valentine's questions from people, but right. Andrew in Cambridge, Mass. Writes, a coworker recently offered me a pair of tickets to a sporting event from his season ticket package, tickets he is unable to use. I accepted and dutifully offered him some cash, which he dutifully declined. But the face value of these tickets is $200, and I feel uncomfortable accepting without some sort of gesture in return. How do I proceed?
Say thank you, and if you want some gesture in return, offer one. Like, you know, take the guy out to dinner. I don't know.
Well, he's saying the guy's refusing his gift.
No, he's refusing payment for it. I think if you said, hey, you know, that was just so awesome that you gave me those tickets, I'd love to return the favor in kind somehow. Could I, you know, take you and your wife out to dinner, or let's get together at this sporting event that I have tickets to, or something like that.
And if they don't accept, thank them twice. Thank them when you get the tickets, and then follow up after the game. Tell them again how it went, how much you appreciated it.
Double thanks.
That said, though, I will say that you should first offer. I think you should offer to pay for them.
He's already done all the things, and now I think he needs to just get over his guilt.
I just got offered tickets the other week in this similar situation, and I didn't offer. Because they were offered
to me. That's because you're you. No.
But I did send a thank you note.
See, that I think that's a polite
you're covered.
Too.
You're covered. In good shape there.
Yeah. And if you know the person, like maybe they're the kind of person that's not going to take your money. I trust you, Brendan.
All right. So our next question comes from Amy in St. Paul, Minnesota. Amy writes, I work in an office and I'm on the phone a lot. When did it become acceptable after calling someone and reaching their voicemail to immediately call back 4 or 5 times in a row and then leave a message? This happens often from both customers and other businesses that should know better. I call this attack calling.
Yeah, it's like basically someone is trying to tell you, pick up the phone, it's super important.
If the question is, when did this become acceptable? It's not.
Yeah.
be aware that what you're communicating by calling repeatedly again and again is urgency and importance and emergency. And it's why it's rude to do it, particularly if there's not a real emergency.
Because in this day and age, actually, a phone call indicates that it's a level of urgency beyond texting, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Already the medium has some message. No
question. Potentially,
exactly.
Yeah.
All right, Amy, there you go. You're in the right.
Yes. Here's something from Jacqueline via Facebook. Jacqueline writes, when given a gift of homemade food like jams or preserves, what does one do with the jar? Oh, these crushing problems that our listeners have.
I was going to say.
But it is. It's a thing. Jacqueline continues, my canning friends are sort of noncommittal, saying you, quote, may return the jar or not. I'm half Japanese, so lack of clarity about social rules makes me crazy, she writes. Please help. WWTPKD. What would the post kids do?
Oh, the post kids.
There's your bumper sticker.
I'm going to make this really clear for Jacqueline. You do not have to return the canning jar. You do not. It is unnecessary.
Yeah, of course not. That's
a part of the gift. Don't worry about it.
Done.
I say keep it for your jelly jar collection that everyone seems to love to drink beer out of these days.
Lack of clarity no more, Jacqueline. Okay, this next one comes from Milos in Oakland. He writes, my employer had failed to account for some paid time off I took over the past 2 years, and now I have more than I would have otherwise accrued.
Mm-hmm.
Do I tell them it's 2.5 days total?
So he's got a little bit more vacation in his docket than he should have.
This is an ethical question, not so much an etiquette question.
Do you want the boring answer or Lizzie's answer?
Let's start with the boring answer.
The boring answer is you tell them. You don't want to get caught.
It's so tempting
to take that prize and run with it, but you don't want to be answering for that years down the road, or a year or 6 months or a month down the road. I say be forthright, be honest, and you're never going to regret it.
All right, Lizzie, your answer?
The sleazy, more fun
the
answer?
The sleazy youngest person at the company always winds up saying, take what you can get and run with it until they catch you.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it's kind of one of those, sometimes bank error in your favor. Collect $200. Like, you know, it's not ethical. It's not honest.
Yeah,
but
we all know it's what the right thing to do here is. But there is an added benefit to what Dan is saying is you will definitely win goodwill. You know, you have a chance of gaining.
Or they'll think you're stupid.
Yeah. No. You might if you were their boss.
I like where you're going with this. Your reputation is important. And it's not just an opportunity to avoid harm. It's an opportunity to really start to build a reputation.
Yeah. That I'll accept.
I plead.
Because I think this is one of those problems, though, that even if you get caught, there are so many easy excuses. It's like, oh, I didn't notice.
Willful ignorance.
Oh, come on. It's what you would do when no one's looking that determines your ethics.
Yeah.
Well, so what?
All right. There you have it, folks. The right way to behave and the way Rico and Lizzie behave. Lizzie and Dan, thanks for coming.
Take good care.
Lizzie Post and Daniel Post Sending, they work at the Emily Post Institute in Vermont, but you can also find them online every week via their podcast, Awesome Etiquette.
And that show is part of the Infinite Guest Podcast Network, of which we are also a part.
Indeed.
To learn more, put the words Infinite Guest in your browser.
Perfect.
But if you want a regular old etiquette question answered, send it to us via our website, dinnerpartydownload.org.
Back in 2003, Andrew Jarecki earned an Oscar nomination for his documentary Capturing the Friedmans, about a seemingly idyllic family, two of whom were accused of child molestation. Jarecki's latest true crime saga is an HBO miniseries called The Jinx. In it, he examines the case of Robert Durst, one-time heir to a multi-million dollar real estate fortune whose wife mysteriously went missing in 1982. Some suspect he killed her. Then years later, a friend of Durst's was found murdered. And a few years after that, Durst admitted he dismembered another man, but was acquitted after arguing it was self-defense. Durst has long declined interviews, but actually asked Jarecki to interview him for this new show. You can see the results when The Jinx premieres this week. And Andrew, thanks for coming by to talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
If this wasn't your first time exploring this issue, for those who don't know, why did Durst come to you specifically to be interviewed?
Well, my partner and I had made a narrative feature about the life of Robert Durst that was called All Good Things. And in it, Ryan Gosling plays a character based on Robert Durst. And then about a week before the movie was coming out in theaters, I got a phone call out of the blue from Bob Durst. So we arranged to have breakfast, and then we showed it to him in Santa Monica at a small screening room. And the idea was he was going to call me a couple days later because he would need some time for it to sink in. In fact, he called me a couple minutes after it ended.
Wow.
And he said, I just want you to know I like the movie very much, and why don't we talk?
Watching you interview him is kind of a bizarre experience. He's rather eccentric, would be the word. At times, kind of seems childish, but then also very cagey. What were your first impressions of him?
Well, I think that as filmmakers, we go through a real journey here because we start with some preconceptions. When we sat down with him and I really got to know him, I was just constantly surprised. I mean, he's an enormously smart person. I think it's kind of an IQ test when you sit down with somebody. You know when you're interviewing somebody how many questions they're reading you in advance. In other words, they're thinking, if you ask them, hey, when were you born? If it's a smart person, they're already saying, all right, he's probably going to ask me, you know, when, how old was I when my mom died? Whatever the next thing is. Bob actually can read maybe 10 or 12 questions in advance. He knows where you're going. He knows what he's been accused of. He knows where the pitfalls are.
Do you believe what he says to you?
Sometimes I do believe him.
But not always.
I'll tell you a very quick Bob story. So we interviewed Bob Durst the first time. And then at a certain point, he decided he didn't want to be interviewed a second time. So we set up maybe 12 interviews with him, and he cancels everyone. We set up the 12th interview, and he calls me a couple days before, and he says, Andrew, I'm sorry, we're not going to be able to do that interview. We're going to have to reschedule. And there's Spanish music playing in the background, and he sounds like he's in a busy restaurant. And I said, well, why can't we do it? He says, I'm in Madrid. I'm in Madrid, and I don't want to come back to New York because the weather is yucky. That's a Bobism. I hang up the phone, and a few minutes later, I'm talking to his assistant. And I say, when was the last time you talked to Bob? He says, oh, I just talked to him a second ago. I said, oh, what did he say? He says, when you talk to Jarecki, don't tell him that I'm in Los Angeles because I just got finished telling him I was in Madrid. I asked Bob a couple weeks later when I'm talking to him, I said, you know, sometimes you tell me stuff that's not true that I don't think you need to tell me. I'm curious about why you feel like sometimes you tell me things that aren't true. He thinks for a long time. He says, you know, Andrew, I've been lying all my life, but nobody ever said I was a particularly good liar.
What do you take from that?
You know, he's one of those people that will often, he's so bright that he will answer a question with a story. But I do think that one of the unique things about Bob is that he's incredibly forthcoming about his own oddities, about his own transgressions, about the fact that he doesn't always tell the truth. There's something very, very engaging about a person who admits to lying.
Well, let's hear a clip from the film. This is Robert Durst talking about meeting his now missing wife.
She thought I was good looking in my little way, cute or whatever it was. And she was very outgoing and social and got along with people real good. So it was perfect because I don't get along with people. Most people don't get along with me.
There's a technique that you use in this film and in a lot of your films. In this movie, you'll see a picture of Robert Durst and his wife, and they're happy and smiling, but there's somebody in voiceover talking about how their marriage is falling apart. And in Capturing the Friedmans, you'll show video of a family that looks very happy, and there's a voiceover of someone talking about how the father is a pedophile. What is it that fascinates you about that idea of the public life versus what's actually happening in the private life?
Well, you know, in our edit room and whenever we sit around and talk about these things, I always say the same thing. I always say both things can be true. You can love your wife and also have violence in your relationship. We see it happen every day in relationships. And I think for me, I'm always interested in monster stories because I always find it so fascinating when people say, well, so-and-so is a terrible person. That person is evil. We say that about other people because we don't want to imagine that we're capable of anything like what these people are capable of. But if we assume that we're nothing like them, that we're a whole different species, what do we learn from spending time with them? Maybe we watch people like a train wreck or we watch people like a car accident. But the truth is we get a lot more out of saying, what do I have in common with this person?
Actually, you may have just answered my next question, but I'm going to throw it out to you anyway. It seems like at this moment, especially with the success of podcasts like Serial, that there's a huge amount of interest in true crime stories. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, it's obvious with things like Serial that people are drawn to the complexity of those stories. And I certainly was, and I liked Serial a lot. And I think, you know, maybe it's that because we're living in a world of such wildly superficial media where things are coming across and, you know, you as much as you can get out of a tweet or out of a text message or out of something in posting, that there really is a desire to see the nuances of it. Because why are we watching these stories, right? We're narcissistic. We want to see ourselves. Why is everybody watching true crime to learn about other people's evil secrets? Because they've all thought about killing their wife. Because they've all thought about doing something terrible. They've all thought about stealing money from their, you know, employer or the bank next to them. They don't do it. But people fantasize about these things. And so they get a chance to see inside the mind of somebody who has done something awful. So I think these things like Serial are... they're tapping into our desire to see ourselves in a more nuanced way, to imagine ourselves in those stories.
I think you're right. I also wonder, though, if there's something to the fact that in recent history, there are many supposedly absolutely true facts we've been told that turned out to not be as true as they were originally portrayed. And I wonder if our interest in stories like in Serial, where the truth seems to be hard to grasp, we're more aware now that that's true, that there are gray areas.
You know, we learn about Christopher Columbus and about, that he discovered America. And then you read Howard Zinn, you know, people's history. And all of a sudden, Christopher Columbus is here in his own diaries crowing about how easy it is to subjugate these Indians, that they're such lovely people, but he could have them all under the knife within a few minutes. Hmm. And you think, oh, so the father of our country, the guy who discovered it all, was a total barbarian. Both things can be true. People can be barbaric and they can be loving parents. People can be a lot of things we don't necessarily expect.
Filmmaker Andrew Jarecki, the weekly HBO documentary series The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst, will debut February 8th on HBO.
Enrico, I promise not to reveal the evil side that lies beneath your genial exterior.
Oh, that's good of you.
Yeah, unless I can use it to blackmail you out of a ton of money.
And there's your evil side. All right, and that's the Dinner Party download for this week, everybody. Tune in next time when our guest will include Marion Cotillard. She will be here to discuss her Oscar-nominated role in the film 2 Days, One Night.
One producer, Jackson Musker, produces the show. Brittany Martin helps us with our digital goings-on. Jen Ramirez, Jeff Peters, and Ravi Carmen engineered the show this week. Our interns are Ed Morales and Christiana Cabal. Peter Clowney is our executive producer. And now it's time for One for the Road, a song to play on your way to... returning from your week's dinner parties.
Unknown Mortal Orchestra is not an orchestra. It's actually just three guys with a taste for atmospheric psychedelic pop. They have a new album coming out in May. This week they released an advanced track just in time for Valentine's Day. It's called Multi-Love.
Bon appetit.
Multi-love checked into my heart and trashed it like a hotel room. Who is your garment? Is she? She wants to bury me in Austin or never she go. She don't want to be a man or a woman. She wants to be your love.
Thanks for attending the Dinner Party Download. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
And I'm Rico Galliano. See you in April.
Wait, what? Where are you going?
I'm going to Bali for a couple of months, dude.
There's no way you've accrued that much vacation.
Shut up. Square.